Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we check in on the Fox comedy Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is a workplace show and a cop show and a romantic comedy and a bunch of other things all rolled up together. Then, in honor of the busy fall we're all having, we're going to talk about some of the pieces of pop culture we really, really intend to get to and don't, and maybe a little about why we don't and what we might do about it. And as always, we will close the show with what's making us happy this week, so don't go away.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For music, games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, right now, check out Ask Me Another. Play along with a Seinfeld-themed version of Taboo, Games of Mysterious Phenomena, and see what you know about some of the lesser-known puppets on Sesame Street. Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now on npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We have Brooklyn, we have procrastination, we have lots more on the show this week. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week, borrowed from his day job at NPR's Ask Me Another, is Pop Culture Happy Hour's producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katzeff. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Now, before we get started, we have to acknowledge, because of all of our weird scheduling stuff, this show's going to run a couple weeks after we're here taping it,
right. Which
means something very specific for Mike.
Yes, that's true. So today, we're recording on the 26th of October, which means that tomorrow, in our time, in our timeline, the World Series starts, which means that for the last few weeks and for the next week after this, I will be doing nothing but obsessing about my rinky-dink sports team, who is not rinky-dink anymore. They're really awesome, and they made it all the way to the World
That's
Series.
Right.
You're
That's
talking
the
about the New York Mets?
The New York Mets.
That team
That's
being
right.
Mike's wonderful Kansas City Royals,
That's
who,
right.
as I told someone the other day, are the closest thing that Pop Culture Happy Hour probably has to an official sports team, simply because of
Packers.
How much we love Mike.
Packers.
Well, that's true.
Packers,
Packers also.
Yeah.
Well, we are always very excited to have Mike with us, never more than when he's filled with hope. It's not that often that we delve into a TV show that's been around for a few seasons, but we're giving it a shot with Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is a Fox comedy that's just entered its third season. It takes place in a, logically enough, Brooklyn police precinct. It has a great big cast, including Andy Samberg as goofball detective Jake Peralta, Andre Brower as the very stern Captain Holt. It's got Terry Crews and Chelsea Peretti, lots more regulars, plus other folks showing up all the time, Mark Evan Jackson, Kira Sedgwick playing wildly against type. Stephen Root, Sandra Bernhardt, Craig Robinson, Patton Oswalt, so on, so on, so on, so on. It's one of those, right? So we thought that we would have a chat about it. So, Thompson, why don't you talk a little bit about where your family is with Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
My family is absolutely across the board in love with this show, including 11-year-old daughter, 14-year-old son, myself, my girlfriend. Everybody has been able to embrace this show. For me, it scratches a little bit of the Parks and Rec itch.
Logically enough, there is executive producer crossover.
There's a lot of executive producer crossover there. It is not as, what's the word, like warm.
Schmoopy.
Okay, yeah,
yes.
That's kind of where I'm going. Like,
right.
I have not been choked up watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine. It is much more like a knockabout, fun workplace comedy mixed in with lots of like funny running gags, little bits that pay off down the line.
Yeah.
The fact that Jake Peralta is obsessed with Die Hard. I love Die Hard.
Yeah.
I liked this show from its first episode.
Mm-hmm.
I was not
slow
to embrace it once I started watching it.
How about you, Glenn?
Yeah, I went from finding this show enjoyable but missable to unmissable, but that took a while. When I was thinking about my reaction to it, I kind of bored myself because it's exactly the same reaction I had to Parks and Rec. It's exactly the same reaction I had to the American Office, which is, it takes a while for this show to find itself. And that makes sense because the process of discovering the show and who these characters are is the same one that we go through, that the directors go through, that the writers go through, that the actors go through. They have to find it. They have
and
to
you're
find
finding
that chemistry.
Strengths that sometimes, until people have played around with them for a while. I mean, I think the American Office playing around with Mindy Kaling was great example of that, where they were playing it kind of that she was a little bit mousy, mm-hmm. and they put her there kind of first to be offended, and she very much was dressed down, and it wasn't until then all of a sudden you get that kind of turned up chatterbox character that eventually really became her thing.
Absolutely.
But not until she had been doing it for a while.
It's about this first reaction you have. My reaction to any kind of sitcom is I'm listening for the jokes. I'm listening for the writing.
Right.
And there comes a moment, and it's usually about midway through the season, when the writing hits me one way, but the performance, the delivery of the line makes it three-dimensional. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you get a sense of this character you didn't have before, because it's kind of like reading a graphic novel where you just kind of skim from word balloon to word balloon. And it takes a while for your eye to really latch onto the art and the imagery and how the tension between the art and the word is actually working. So here, there's moments, and it happened a lot in the first season, when all of a sudden this character comes alive because the actor sort of owns it and the writers are writing for the strengths of that particular person.
Right.
I also think the show endeared itself to me with the very smart hiring of Mark Evan Jackson.
For sure.
As Holt's husband. That's just that the casting. We've talked about before about how casting can endear you to a show.
There is a real genius to the casting.
It reflects
the
sensibility. And if you share that sensibility, it just works.
How about you, Mike? You know, Mike and I were talking about this a little bit, about how you get at why you like a sitcom.
Yeah.
Besides, I just like it. There's a lot to say about why this show works. So where did you come out, Mike?
So I think the comparisons, obviously, to Parks and Rec and The American Office are right. I think what makes the show work for me is the relationships between the characters. They pair them off in the most logical ways, and then as it goes on, they get the odd pairings of people who don't mix together to do something that brings out a different comedic side to both of them. Obviously, from the get-go, Jake Peralta and Captain Holt's antagonism was a big part of the show's tension in the comedy, and he's a goofball, and Holt is so flat that he's almost playing it as a drama. Andre Bauer is playing as a drama. He's in a completely different cop show, but as time goes on, when they pair together, it brings out something completely different out of both of them, mm-hmm. where they can both be weird in their own specific ways.
Right.
As Andre Bauer continues that performance, his completely flat, robotic joylessness that is built into his persona gets teased out little bits where there's little quirks in there that are so bizarre that anybody, including any robot human, would think of. And it's just so smart where you see Amy and Holt as her being sort of the teacher's pet, like Tracy Flick in Election, kind of sucking up. But she can also sort of be weird and quirky and bizarre in addition to sort of being like the goody two-shoes at the same time.
Absolutely.
So you see more depth as it goes on. And I think that's just like the writers finally learning how to write for these characters.
Right.
Yeah, they do a wonderful job of doling out the payoffs with each character over, you know, over time. And one of my favorite examples of that really is with Ray Holt, who they start early on. You get one little quick flashback to Ray Holt as a hard-bitten 80s detective with hair and a mustache and calling people punk. And you start to get a sense like they're going to keep very judiciously doling out these moments over the course of this series in ways that are going to get funnier and funnier and funnier. And they've done a very nice job loosening him up very gradually while keeping him the same character. And the casting, you talk about casting, Andre Bauer, homicide life on the streets, Andre Bauer, like Emmy-laden, serious dramatic actor Andre Bauer, playing a serious character and then letting him show how unbelievably funny he is.
Everyone, I'm your new commanding officer, Captain Ray Holt.
Speech!
That was my speech.
Yes?
I was hula hooping. Kevin and I attend a class for fitness and for fun.
Oh, my God.
I've mastered all the moves. The pizza toss, the tornado, the scorpion, the oopsie doodle.
Why are you telling me this?
Because no one will ever believe you.
No.
It's impossible to talk about the great things about this show without a little bit of a detour into how lovely it is that the cast of this show and the characters on the show are as diverse as they are. Effortlessly so. Not in a kind of studied thing that makes you feel like it's been kind of concocted this way. to stand for this, but in a way that's like in a Brooklyn police precinct, you would run into a mix of people. Particularly in the case of Holt, the fact that he's playing a Black gay police detective is not in and of itself a joke, right? Mm-hmm. That's not the joke. But it's also not irrelevant. He'll tell people right out, particularly he's had these conversations with his nemesis, who is this woman played by Kira Sedgwick, where he'll just tell her straight out, I was an out gay police detective, you know, in the 80s or whenever, right, whenever he came out. And he sort of says, therefore, I'm much tougher than you. And it's clear that that's all true. It's clear that his untouchable personality and his unflappable nature has been both necessary because of and possible because of specific things about who he is as a person, not all of which have anything to do with the fact that he's a gay Black police detective, but some of them do.
Yep.
There's specificity, but there's also just character stuff, right?
It informs sort of like his professionalism, which I think across the board, this is a show where we're sort of in a time where cops doing a bad job is all over the news, and it dances like this line of, if you show cops screwing up too much and being stupid, it's not a good look. And they dance the line of them being funny and crazy and have fun, but also at the end of the day, they all kind of do their jobs great.
Right.
Even like the two dullard side cops.
Have talent.
Yeah. They just are lazy.
Right.
But they show that they all are talented and good at what they do.
Yeah, it's more a sitcom than it is a cop show, although it has a lot of the tropes of the cop show.
Yeah.
And they really, it's hermetically sealed. And it's important that it is, because they don't show them pulling their guns when they shouldn't. And every so often, there is a storyline. Like, there was recently a storyline about where they're trying to rehabilitate the image of the NYPD.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, yeah, they're cops. Because it does have such a workplace sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
Also, because it is an ensemble, and because the tension between Holt and Peralta and the rest of the squad is so gentle, that tension exists within the ensemble, within the precinct. And the real plot-driven conflict comes from outside. So it's enemies from outside, which is kind of surprising, only three seasons in, that's the dynamic that we've kind of settled into.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, as Mike mentioned, they are mixing and matching all these members of this ensemble to kind of show, and so they kind of bounce off each other and you can kind of see new sides of them. I like the mixing. I'm not crazy about the matching. We've had Boyle plus Rosa. We've had Boyle plus Gina. And we've got Jake plus Amy. And I'm not seeing a lot of sparks there. In terms of chemistry, it does feel like narratively imposed. Like, here's let's figure out what happens now, which is perfectly valid. I'm just surprised to see it happening at the beginning of season three.
Yeah, and I did not have the reaction with Jake and Amy that you would with, like, Jim and Pam on The Office. I don't necessarily want those crazy kids to get together. And as for Boyle and anyone, I don't want to see it.
Yeah,
I think that's
I'm not.
But I think that's like everybody, though. Everybody does, you know, he's so sort of sex crazed and he's like this foodie romantic and yet kind of gross and crass at the same time. I think they're playing that as he doesn't really pair with anyone perfectly. And I think that's where Joe LaTriglia plays that so well, I think.
I like Jake and Amy. I like that relationship. I do buy them.
I love both those actors.
But the Boyle stuff has always been complicated for me. And the complication of the Boyle stuff started for me. He's sort of the bumbling office weirdo. And when he was introduced, the driving thing about that character was that he was obsessed with this other character, Rosa, and absolutely was unable to hear her say, no, I don't want to go out with you. I'm not interested. And was sort of obsessively pursuing her.
Right.
And we actually had at Press Tour a session, a panel with the writers and the cast of this show. And I asked the question. I said, this was between season one and season two, how long that's funny.
Right.
Because at some point, if you really had a guy who was this unwilling to take no for an answer from a woman at work, that becomes unfunny to me. And it becomes, I think, unfunny to a lot of people, but maybe particularly a lot of women. On the one hand, the producers kind of blew it off. They kind of like chuckled and said, like, well, it's obvious that it comes from, like, he's not a threatening person.
Right. She can certainly hold her own.
Yeah,
she's
kind of a badass on the show, too.
At the same time, by the beginning of season two, they immediately started to pull away from it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear that by the time I asked that question, they were well into pulling away from that and retreating from it. But that was an example to me of the entire, I think, reason we're talking about this show, which is kind of the phenomenon of watching a show kind of get on its feet.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they have to do sometimes is walk away from some of the premises of the way they set up those characters.
I think if anything, that does at least illuminate like one aspect of his personality, which is like this kind of endless romanticism or positivity and like this loyalty to his friends, whether it's him and Jake or him and Rosa. Like they've actually become close friends at this point. And I think this show, more than Parks and Rec, really kind of tamps down most of the romance, I would say. It's there, but it's not certainly as front and center as Ben and Leslie Knope,
right?
You know, on Parks and Rec.
One of the things that has surprised me about this show is that when it was premiering, and Alan Sepinwall wrote something about this recently in connection with an episode that they did that revolved around a serial killer. But one of the questions that we had, I think a lot of the critics that I knew when the show started, was how are you going to do comedy around crime? Mm-hmm. And one of the things I find interesting, this show is not a cringe comedy. It's not a kind of ugly bad person comedy, which is a lot of what comedy is right now on television. Mm-hmm. It is fundamentally a show about people you're supposed to like Parks and Rec, like The Office. But at the same time, it deals with this very dark world. I mean, they do a lot of property crime. They don't do murder every
week. Yeah, I was going to say, it's a lot of capers.
They don't do murder every week by any means. And so it's interesting that the show, on the one hand, doesn't have the interpersonal darkness of a show like Louie, for example, mm-hmm. but has vast darkness just outside the boundaries of what's going on in the show.
But they also keep within their world several sources of just joy and light. Mm-hmm. And so you are constantly getting these infusions of Terry Jeffords is maybe my favorite character on TV right now.
Yeah, Terry Crews.
The wonderful, wonderful Terry Crews, yeah. Who's such a big goofball. Chelsea Peretti as Gina, mm-hmm. who brings so much
weirdness,
weird, quirky energy that is constantly bouncing off the other characters in surprising ways. Even Scully and Hitchcock, who, you know, the two kind of lazy old,
as Mike said, side cops.
Side cops. They're the cilantro. You know, they're mm-hmm. there to occasionally be doing something doofy for 10 seconds, land a punchline, and then just bounce to another character. Yeah. They have the ratio of these characters they get almost entirely right, except I think I feel like there's a little too much Boyle.
The other thing that I would add to your kind of they bring in a lot of joy and light on a regular basis is how good of a job they've done creating some of those recurring people who only show up mm-hmm. now and then. Mm-hmm. Craig Robinson playing the Pontiac Bandit. Mm-hmm. Patton Oswalt is the fire chief.
Yeah.
And most of those, to me, have been winners, right?
Yeah.
And they're people that you look at and you say, they could bring that person back in anytime.
Right.
Bradley Whitford, who played Jake's dad.
Yeah. Speaking of great casting.
Yeah, absolutely. Dean Winters, who played Dennis Duffy on 30 Rock, who plays this guy that they call the Vulture.
Yep.
And he's kind of doing the thing
he does. He's basically doing what he has done in the Mayhem commercials and Dennis Duffy.
But it's a meaner version of Dennis Duffy.
It is, if that's possible. Mm-hmm. A more bullying version.
A more bullying version of Dennis Duffy. I think it's less whiny, more bullying.
And one area where this show for me really crosses over with the experience of watching Parks and Rec is that I find myself protective of these characters mm-hmm. and a little too much meanness from outside forces, whether it's Wunsch, who's played by Kira Sedgwick, or the Vulture, played by Dean Winters. I tend to kind of get my back up and not want too much of that conflict because it's such a light comfort foodie show. I was so relieved as in this season as they started to shift away from a little too much of those outside forces.
Yeah, and speaking of outside forces, the format of the show, this is one of the things that took me a while to warm up to, is there's a lot of cutaways, which increases the joke density, just quick mm-hmm. little bits. But that's the format of Family Guy, and that's something I kind of like shy against. But then I realized, oh, Family Guy does a reference when it goes away, and these guys do a joke. It's a big difference.
Yes. They do a joke. And I will say, I think this show has maybe right now the strongest cold opens of anybody in television. In a cold open in which they are betting on what is keeping Amy from being to work on time. And the end of that cold open was something that I immediately looked at and everybody said, well, that's going to be a GIF. That's going to be a Vine, which it immediately was. Mm-hmm. I think that was my moment of just absolutely falling in love with this show.
For me, one of the things is like we've talked in the past about like recurring episodes of a show, like the Halloween episodes of Roseanne or the Halloween episodes of The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. The Halloween episodes of this show. Mm-hmm. There have been three of them now, and Each one involves a competition between Jake and Ray Holt. They're trying to prove that they can outsmart each other by stealing.
Yeah.
In the first couple, Jake is trying to steal something from Ray Holt, and Ray Holt is trying to thwart him.
Right.
They have managed to escalate those each season, and back to back to back, those are just so wonderfully fun. Like, as long as this show stays on air, I am looking forward to Halloween, in part because I am looking forward to the Halloween episode
of
this
show. It's like Bar Wars.
I was just going to say, it's like the Bar Wars. Yep. It's this battle of wits that just keeps escalating.
And it's also one of those times when they kind of dispense with the notion that this is actually a working precinct.
Right.
And just go for the comedy.
Yeah, there's no crime on Halloween.
No crime on Halloween. All right. Well, I look forward to hearing what all of you think about Brooklyn Nine-Nine. If you're not checking it out, I do encourage you to watch it. It's available on Hulu and some other places. Brooklyn Nine-Nine, just into its third season. Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH and tell us what you think. Now, when we come back, you know, it was a topic that started off as a joke, but it's not a joke. We're going to talk about all the stuff that we keep meaning to get to that we haven't gotten to yet. So stick around.
Support for this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour comes from Casper. They're an online retailer for mattresses. Casper mattresses are American-made and obsessively engineered for comfort. They use two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, to give just the right amount of sink and bounce. And they have a risk-free trial. You can try out your Casper mattress for 100 days with free delivery and returns. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. So go to casper.com/happyhour to check out their options. And they have a special offer for listeners of this podcast. Use the promo code HAPPYHOUR to redeem $50 towards a Casper mattress that works for you.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we talked about Brooklyn Nine-Nine. You know, that's a show that we've gradually gotten into. Now we're going to talk about some stuff that we haven't gotten into. Now, this topic started because we were talking about what was on our minds this week, and it was Mike who said, described the topic thusly. What did he call it?
Pop culture I hope to finally get around to one day when I have some damn spare time to myself. Oh God, I'm so tired. I just need to lie down for a second, but I promise I'll get to it soon.
Yeah, it's the title of this segment. That's the title of this segment. Mike, I read that title, and I hear a wail of despair.
The Mike Katzen story.
It's not really that despairing.
The Mike Katzen story.
We all go through like these cycles of consume and also cycles of create. And I feel like lately I've just been making and really busy with stuff. And so all of the things that I would be reading or watching or taking in, it just kind of sits on the bedside table, so to speak.
While you watch baseball.
And that's a big part of it, too, is normally this time of year, I'm not watching baseball because my team is not in it. But now I can't miss like a single minute. So any free moment, I've been kind of doing other things. So when we were thinking of what else were we watching, I'm like, I kind of don't know what I'm watching. And here's a list of things that I like. So,
yeah. What is on your list of things where it's like, I want to get around to this, but I haven't yet?
Sure. So I have Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me that's sitting next to my bed. I'm like, I need to get past like the first chapter of this book.
Mike, it's so slim and thin. It's such a quick read. You're going to knock it out in a day. It's great. You will not be able to stop reading.
It's one of those kind of books that I feel like I want to do the justice of really sitting and thinking about it. I've also had Questlove's biography on that same table for maybe 2.5 years. So it's not like I'm a fast reader. So there's stuff like that that I feel like I really want to like put a lot of time into. But then there's also like TV shows where either I hear really great things about it, but at this point they're into 8 seasons, like The Good Wife. Mm-hmm. I know everything about it because people that I know love that show, but man, like, it's kind of a commitment that I have yet to put into.
TV is a tough one. Yeah. Particularly TV dramas are a tough one. Yeah. That's a lot to get through.
I also feel like I'm the kind of personality who likes to start from the beginning of things.
Yeah,
me too.
And
there's the problem.
But not always. You know, I come to other stuff late. So, like, the big, big one that's really been on my list for, like, a really long time is the TV show The Shield, which I feel like I've done my due diligence with kind of the godfather, so to speak, of the prestige television of like the 90s and 2000s, The Sopranos, The Wire, Deadwood, Mad Men, blah, 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 all like these like dark anti-hero characters. But after pulling through all of those, oh my God, I can't start like another one of those super heavy, depressing.
You don't have to, you know.
I mean, I don't have to, but it's the kind of show that I feel like I would love. And there's elements of that show that between the cast, the creators, things like that, that I know that I would really like that show. I just
There's also 7 seasons of it.
Yeah. There's 7 seasons of it, and I kind of have like a one-in, one-out policy. So
right.
I kind of waited for Mad Men to end before I started getting into the most recent season of The Americans.
Yep.
So once that finished, that's when I had time to finally get into Mr. Robot. Like, I kind of try with those kind of shows to really
like
only delve into
serious,
one.
Serialized shows.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. How about you, Glenn? What are you thinking?
I am not over... bothered by this. Is that a word? Overbothered? I am not a completist. I am not a collector. I am a happy dilettante.
Right.
A dabbler.
I think this is an important question, yeah. right? Because it is much more possible. Now, there are shows where it would be hard to make this work, right? With a show like Mike mentioned, The Americans is
yep.
one. Can't kind of dip in and dip out and all that easily.
Yeah. Well, I'm not just talking about television.
No, I know. But in the case of television, I think it's a good example because I don't think you could do that with The Americans. I do think Mike could do it with The Good Wife. It just
sure.
depends on the show. Mm. But the problem is, I feel like we knew this before there was such a thing as DVD sets and streaming.
Right.
We knew this. Like, this was a common thing that people did. They watched a show, but not all the time.
Right.
Whereas now, it's like you're either a student of the show
yeah.
or you're not qualified to participate in talking about it. And with a lot of shows, if you're not going to be allowed to talk about it, why watch it? But say what you were going to say about not
well,
being...
no, it's just also another point is that with social media, you hear so much about a show,
right.
even especially when people don't use the freaking hashtags. And then you start to get, you feel like you've experienced
yeah.
it already. You've seen the titles of the think pieces and you kind of...
I know a lot about Game of Thrones for someone who doesn't watch it.
Exactly. Yeah. But in terms of like movies. Okay, so I have seen, it turns out, I have seen the lion's share of Hitchcock films. Many.
Mm-hmm.
He's guy's done 52 films. I've seen, I was over at a friend's house, who is a collector and a completist.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out of his 52 films, I have seen 49.
Wow.
Very
now, those
good.
Last, and I wasn't trying to do it. It just happens over the course of 47 years on the planet. You
sure.
see stuff.
But some of those early films are really minor.
Yes, that's the thing. And the ones I haven't seen turn out to be Torn Curtain, Topaz, and Family Plot, his last few.
Oh, Family Plot.
And I have no particular driving interest in doing so, just because I've heard bad things about them. It's that thing. You live in this
yeah.
bubble of hearing it's bad or hearing it's not worth it. And I explained this to my friend, and he said, you've seen 49 out of the 52? And sweat started to appear
like,
in his upper
lip.
Like,
why wouldn't you just want to
finish
it?
What are you doing? Like,
yeah.
why don't you? And I just don't have that. And so the things that I think about, the limiting reagent in the case of Hitchcock is interest, but the limiting reagent for most things is time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
yeah.
feel, I believe in this perfectly mythical, far off time of just blissful uninterruptedness
mm-hmm.
that doesn't exist,
yeah.
never has existed, and it never
yeah.
will exist.
Yeah.
Right, but I believe in it. And then in the future, I will become the kind of person who has read Samuel Pepys' Diaries and Life of Johnson and all these big
mm-hmm.
tweedy, pipe-smoking kind of books
sure.
that I desperately want to.
Do you need to.
To
become more pipe-smoky and tweedy than you already are?
I want to become the person who has done that already.
Yes.
I imagine like the book, The Riverside Shakespeare? Are you familiar with this idea, The Riverside Shakespeare? It's this giant hunk and tome that puts every Shakespeare play in one big book.
Mm.
And it's called The Riverside Shakespeare. And ever since I was 5 and I heard that, I imagine myself by a river under a tree reading from cover to cover, The Riverside Shakespeare.
Do you have it? Do you own it?
Don't own it. And as a kid, that sounds like a real cool thing to do if you're a nerd. And if as an adult, it says, well, there's going to be snakes and bugs and it's like that
yeah.
is a dumb thing to do.
Yeah.
It's going to be hot. No.
Tick.
I have giant collections that we discussed before of these awful comic books from the 80s that I imagine I will go back to one day and yeah. read the complete works of Booster Gold and Amazing Man and Amethyst Princess of Gemworld. I will find that they are inferior to my recollection of them, but that is what collectors of comic books believe in, as we've talked about
mm-hmm.
before, this idea that at some point there will be time.
Yeah. How about you, Thompson?
Yeah. I've talked before on this show about that mythical leg in traction time
mm-hmm.
when you are going to suddenly have the time to catch up on all the things that you've missed. And this past weekend, I got laid up with you may have noticed, a big bad chest cold settled right behind my solar plexus. No energy whatsoever to do anything but lie around. And, I watched Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which I had already seen.
Yeah.
Same. And, you know, because when you were laid up, when certainly if my leg were in traction, I'd probably be on some sort of painkillers, one would hope. I am not going to be in a place to suddenly, like, dredge through an incredibly important piece of television history like The Wire. I am much more likely to watch candy.
Yeah.
And the
because
stuff.
Because it's downtime.
Because it's downtime, exactly. I'm not doing it for work. Mm-hmm. I don't need to be edifying myself when I'm laid up. And so I have all queued up the stuff that I most want to get around to watching. I did fixate largely on television for this for some reason. And a lot of it was like stuff that I started watching, usually for this show, ended up really liking, and set aside like, I can't wait to watch the rest of it. And then I waited to watch the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a list of things like Orange is the New Black. I didn't get through the last few episodes of Transparent, which I need to do before we get to the next ones because I love the first one so much. I didn't quite finish Show Me a Hero, a show I really liked. I didn't finish the first season of Fargo, a show I really liked. I didn't finish BoJack Horseman, a series I really liked. I didn't finish Mr. Robot, a series I really liked. I did finish Kimmy Schmidt because it is comfort food.
Yeah.
It is, if I were laid up, I could easily rewatch Kimmy Schmidt. And so a lot of that stuff is just a matter of setting aside and just dedicating myself to watching. All these shows are, to varying degrees, fun, but they're not frothy.
Well, and here's the other thing. We talk so much about the binge watch, and we talk so much about, oh, you can take a weekend and catch up on that whole show. It's going to be great. There are certain shows that are not meant to be watched that way.
Right.
And I really believe that one thing that's going to happen, if we're going to move toward a situation where more and more shows will be dropped in a Netflix style, mm-hmm. right, where the whole season comes out at once, everybody's not going to watch everything in 13-hour chunks.
Yeah.
So at some point, I personally believe we're going to back a little bit away from the idea of the watch 10 episodes of something in a row.
Yeah.
Because for me, anything that's dramatically heavy, I don't necessarily want to watch more than about two mm-hmm. of, because it begins to be punishing in a way that's not consistent with the artistic intent. I think sometimes people skip episodes of shows thinking, I'm just going to catch up on that. I can catch up on that in a weekend. But then you don't.
Right.
Because the idea of catching up, like, that's how I fell behind on things that, like Stephen says, things that are heavy that I liked, like The Americans, for example, when I first started to fall behind on The Americans, which I had watched quite a bit of. It was that feeling of like, you think you're going to get to it. And then all of a sudden, the idea of watching five episodes of that is a daunting way for me to try to spend a Saturday.
Well, I'm finding October is actually becoming one of my favorite months as a music fan. Because in my little world, the release calendar is such that you get advances of new albums 3 months before they come out, give or take. And there's a dead zone at the end of the year where they're not really putting out a lot of records in December or early January. So in October, there is this blissful silence in which I'm gathering up all the albums from 2015 that I want to hear for year-end coverage, just for my own edification. And October is the blissful month of catching up.
And also re-listening to stuff.
And re-listening to stuff.
Paid attention to.
And so, like, November and December, I'll be tied up in year-end stuff. January, there's going to be a whole ton of stuff to write about. I know this is a little bit inside baseball because I'm talking about this as a reviewer, but having a month where you are not suddenly barraged with new music, where every once in a while it's like, oh, there's a new Adele song.
Yeah.
So I need to stop and give 5 minutes over to that, or in my case, 30 minutes to listen to it six times.
But you're barraged in October with holiday music, are you not?
I'm not listening to it.
Okay.
I see how it is.
So there are occasional exceptions, but what I'm mostly doing is I'm actually, I think, listening to more music than usual because I feel like I'm chipping away at a finite thing. Mm-hmm. And that is very satisfying. If there's like an end point where I can feel at least on some level like I've caught up, even though, of course, you can never catch up. We've talked before. Linda wrote this wonderful essay, mm-hmm. which we should link to on the blog. Was it the wonderful, tragic?
It's a sad, beautiful fact that we're all going to miss almost everything.
It's such a good essay. It's one of my favorite Linda Holmes essays. And it's just basically about letting yourself off the hook for not having read every classic, seen every great movie, being up on every TV show. You literally can't. You can't do it, and it's only accelerating. The volume of stuff in the world is only growing. It's never going to contract.
It's not just that you can't see everything good. It's that, this is basically what the essay is about, mm-hmm. you are going to be a person at the end of your life who, compared to how much stuff there is, saw statistically nothing.
Right.
That's just the way we are.
Right.
And it's just the way the math works out. I did some of the math in the piece. It's just the way humans are, and it is part of how I react to this kind of thing. Like, obviously, because of what my job is, I try to see more stuff. But even in that case, it's like you can't try to make yourself some kind of cultural completist. Right. It's absolute folly. Yeah.
And because of that, I think I like to seek out opportunities for finite deep dives. When I put together the Austin 100, it's like you start out with 2,000 songs, but it's not 2,000 plus question mark.
Right.
And so you're chipping away at a big block of something. I love chipping away at big blocks.
Hell's Kitchen.
Hell's Kitchen, of course. the more nebulous it is, the harder it is to attack it.
Yeah, I get that.
There's a lot of freedom in just like letting go. Like when you feel like they're packing up, try not watching it for a while.
Yeah.
And like that pressure to watch it kind of goes away, and I'm surprised how much I don't miss certain things that I just like let lapse.
Yeah, my friend Tara Ariano is famous for being a person who quits shows in the middle of an episode. she will just be watching the episode and she'll be like, nope, and then she just turns it off and quits the show forever and never goes back. And it's one of my favorite things about her because I think it's hilarious.
I did that with Designing Women when they had Meshach Taylor dangling from some. He was rotating? I don't know.
Anyway, I don't even know if it has to be that dramatic. It's just, she loves the fact that she's not a bitter ender in terms of getting all the way to the end of a show, but she doesn't even have to get to the end of the episode. She'll be like, I'm no longer enjoying this. Boom. Yeah. Out it goes. No worry about the sunk costs or any of that.
Yeah.
You
the
just
literary,
stop watching.
The literary equivalent of that is, I just threw the book across the room, those people.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just, it's not, that's not about the book. That's about you and your reaction.
Right.
It just
sure.
seems so overdramatic and gross.
No. Oh, that makes sense. All right. Well, I will be interested to hear again what folks have to say about this very issue. I want to hear all about the stuff that you're trying to get to that you haven't gotten to yet. We haven't listed too many of our specific things because that's kind of not the point, but I want to hear your specific things. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it is going to be time for our favorite segment of this and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company dedicated to helping clients achieve lifelong financial well-being. An award-winning global asset manager, TIAA CREF was founded nearly a century ago to serve those who serve others in the academic, medical, cultural, governmental, and research fields. Its investment model and long-term approach are aimed at delivering outcomes that benefit clients. TIAA CREF. Created to serve and built to perform at TIAA.org. TIAA CREF Individual and Institutional Services, LLC.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We have arrived at our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Just a light, goofy grab bag for me. One, a little bit of house cleaning. I got to appear recently on the wonderful Slate podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, where I got to go to one of their live shows and appear with our pal, Dan Coyce, and Allison Benedict talking about parenting, getting to look across the stage at those lovely people and then see further across the stage at my lovely children who are in attendance. I do recommend that podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, but there is one specifically that I got to be on.
Nice.
As well as such D-listers as John Dickerson, host of Face the Nation, and Valerie Jarrett, who's like a chief advisor to the Obama administration.
Yeah.
So yeah, they put me on first for some reason. I was like, you don't blow the biggest name first.
You just opened for Nirvana, basically.
I did. But that show was really, really fun. Speaking of really, really fun, been catching up on movies with the kids, sat down with the kids, and rewatched Live, Die, Repeat, the film formerly known as Edge of Tomorrow.
It's still Edge of Tomorrow. I'm not listening to this.
It says Live, Die, Repeat on the DVD, but Edge of Tomorrow, it's still such a fun movie. If anything, it's a little more fun on a smaller screen. Some of its flaws when you're sitting there like bolted to it kind of dissipate when you're just giggling with your kids. That's such a fun movie. And finally, speaking of catching up on old things, as we did in our previous segment, not a show that I expected to be ever watching, but my girlfriend Katie has been watching Nashville.
Sure.
I think that my description was that, you know, she moved away from Austin and moved here. And my description of the show is it's like Austin methadone. So, you know, if like Friday Night Lights is just a little too raw, it just thrums too many emotions.
Sure.
But Nashville being exactly halfway between DC and Austin is just kind of scratching just enough of that itch without hurting the wound.
Sure, yes.
That is a big, pulpy, silly slice of silly.
Yes, it is.
And a perfect show to have on in the background.
There you go.
So it is not a show that I ever thought, like, oh, man, I need to catch up on Nashville.
Okay.
But I'm getting a kick out
of it. Did you watch it from the beginning?
Yeah, we started at the beginning.
Okay. And do you agree with the cognoscenti out there that it got really crazy? It took a while for it to kind of find its
it
soap
is,
opera
that
craziness.
Is a show that has really needed some time to figure out exactly what it is. And I've seen promos for later seasons that basically just consist of women lifting shirts to reveal bras. Mm-hmm. So I gather it's moved more and more in that direction. But they've been laying the groundwork, and I'm just investing so little emotion in it
that
I'm having fun.
Fair enough. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
You know, I saw the film Crimson Peak this week in an empty theater with pal Chris Klimek. It is the Guillermo del Toro gothic Castle of Otranto weirdness. It's full of melodramatic excess. It's clicking every box. There's a madwoman. There's a ghost. Whatever. It's visually striking. If that's what you're going for, it does check that box. I kind of was hoping for it to be a little bit more swoony and feverish and operatic. Those are all synonyms for gayer. I was kind of hoping it would steer into the skid and get bigger and gayer, and it didn't quite. So the name of the segment is not what's making me pleasantly disposed toward it.
Uh-huh.
The name of the segment is what's making me happy.
Yeah.
It's a high bar. We've always said it's a high bar.
Right. Sure.
So I'm going to switch over to, you know, you've talked about the show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Yes.
And I agree with some of the points that the title is off-putting. The premise is kind of off-putting, where she picks up from her successful career in New York and goes to
West Covina,
California, to chase after this dud of an ex-boyfriend.
Yes.
I do think that the show is doing all of that very knowingly. It knows that this guy is a dud, and I trust that the arc of the show will be her discovering coming to understand.
Well, because she met that nice coffee shop guy.
Absolutely.
Who I am a little in love with.
So, specifically, there is a performance on the show which we talked about. Usually it takes a little bit of time for the writer and then the actor to kind of come together to produce this very specific, wonderful performance, but the Broadway actress, Donna Lynn Champlin, as Paula Proctor,
yes,
the paralegal.
The friend.
That is the, you know, the supportive friend who's caustic. That is a classic trope. And yet she is being so specific and so funny. And it's one of those moments when you have to rewind, not because you missed the line, but you want to see that performance of that line again. It's a great performance. It is, for me, the heart of the show. I mean, everybody's on it is great, but man, those scenes between the main character and Donna Lynn Champlin, who, you know, New York City actress, put in her time on Law & Order, put out an album. But this performance is worth watching the show. It's great.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Well, not Glenn Weldon, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Mike Katziff, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
So I do have time. If I don't have time for books, I have time for a single issue of a comic book. Paper Girls is a new series by Brian K. Vaughan and Cliff Chang. Brian K. Vaughan, most people at this point probably know that he writes the comic book Saga, which is this gigantic, sweeping epic that is a very great comic book that I feel like a lot of people in the last couple of years have been into. He also wrote The Runaways, Why the Last Man, these very big, high-concept books that are sort of pushing normal people into like these big, dramatic situations. Where Paper Girls kind of flips the script a little bit. It's a lot like what I would describe as an Amblin Entertainment, like 80s-style book. It's about four teenage girls who are paper delivery girls, not paper boys, but paper girls, in a suburb in 1989. And for most of the comic, it's very much kind of a YA story about these girls who are sort of outcasts and getting made fun of as they're on their paper route. And instead of going in the direction of that, you start to see like these little hints of weird sci-fi, alien, apocalyptic-y kind of things happening just on the fringes. But for the most part, it's this really cool, intimate story about girls and the way that they sort of interact, you know, as teenagers in the 80s. Brian K. Vaughan has like a tendency, I think, to write comic books or graphic novels that are perfect for people that you would want to give to someone who has never read a comic book before. And I feel like this issue, it's a great pilot episode. If they were ever to make a TV series of it, it would be a perfect cliffhanger at the end. So I would totally recommend this series. You can get in right on the ground floor. There's, I think, as of this taping, I think there's only one issue out. So Paper Girls. It's really great.
Mike, do you know if it's a limited series or is it just going to be an ongoing?
I think it's an ongoing. He has a couple other things that are limited right now that are going on, but like Saga, I think this may go on for a while.
Cool.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Thank you very much, Mike Katzeff. Making me happy this week, I have a great read for you. There was a piece in Cosmopolitan by Jasmine Hughes, who works at the New York Times Magazine, who talked about when she arrived at the Times feeling out of place, feeling like it's what they refer to, as everyone does, as imposter syndrome. She talks about, I don't know why these people hired me. I don't feel at home here. I don't feel accepted here. And her solution, for whatever reason, was an experiment in which she dressed like Cookie from Empire, meaning she very specifically imitated specific outfits of Cookies from Empire. And so this involved, you know, some of it was just regular stuff that kind of dressed up to look cookie-ish. And some of it is outlandish, expensive cookie stuff. It's much more flashy than what she was wearing. It's much more attention-getting than what she was wearing. And she talks about the power of the way you present yourself as a compliment to kind of how you feel walking through the world. And it's not as simple as I dressed up and it made me feel more confident. It is really getting at these questions about identity and what it means to kind of assume a position of power in the world as you walk through it. Assume a position of people should look at me and pay attention to me and I take up space and all of that stuff. It has some very, very good writing in it. I'm just going to read this little bit that talks about one development where she had worn a particular thing. From then on, the challenge was just a fun game of what would I wear if I were rich and ridiculous? I got to carry a purse worth more than my couch. I wore a fur coat to brunch and got to text the words, I am wearing a fur coat to brunch. I took more selfies than I have all year. I started a group text with all my closest female friends, sending them each day's outfit before I left the house. Their praise, emoji-laden and sweet, pushing me out onto the street, holding me up. There is a lot going on in this piece. It's also funny. It's also really fun to look at the clothes and try to figure out which of those pieces you actually could afford and which one is suddenly going to be like, this costs $4,000. It's great fun. There are tons of pictures. It's great, great fun. Again, in Cosmopolitan, Jasmine Hughes writing about dressing like Cookie from Empire, and we will put a link to that on the blog. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. And you can follow Mike, our producer emeritus and music director, at Mike Katzeff, KATZIF. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And know, as always, that Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. And maybe Mike is too. Mm-hmm. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. And we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For music, games, puzzles, and trivia of all sorts, right now, check out Ask Me Another. Play along with a Seinfeld-themed version of Taboo, Games of Mysterious Phenomena, and see what you know about some of the lesser-known puppets on Sesame Street. Ask Me Another is like Trivia Night, but a lot funnier. Play along now on npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.